your neighbor's hand, say, great to see you in church tonight. Then you may be seated. All right. I'm getting out the bio. Here it is. Here's the bio. There we go. Are you ready? Patrick Norris, a popular speaker around the world with a passion to empower people to walk in the power of redemption. He's known for his depth of thought. He's the smartest dude I know, personally. Seriously, he is. Sophisticated ideas and motivational inspiration. He radiates with fresh ideas, bringing colorful beauty from ancient texts. Drawing from his certification as a multiple sexual addiction professional, International Institute of Trauma and Addiction Professionals, combined with his love for Jesus theology, he has a passion to help people know why they do what they do, whether in addiction or simple hyperreactions. His training and backgrounds and relationships with professionals in neuropsychology positions him to give tremendous help to anyone who suffers. For the most ardent, maladaptive, I say that right? I practice. Behaviors of someone who just wants to figure themselves out, Patrick has dedicated his life to lead people into the power of redemption. He has been privileged to minister to global audiences in churches. We're live tonight on Facebook too. I'm looking really good tonight. And Bible colleges for over 30 years. He's the founding and senior pastor of Life Point Church in Kansas City, Olathe, Kansas. The love of Patrick's life is his wife of 27 years, Tina. He has a great wife. Along with their two adult sons, Evan and Mitchell, as a family, they're all committed to the ancient truths of scriptures as they help people recover from the traumatic effects from Adam's sin, their choices, and the perpetrating suffering caused by their offenders. Now, let me talk from the heart. I've known Brother Patrick. Patrick Norris was the second guest minister in the history of this church. 1985, I was still at Rhema. Dave and Marlos were here. And how many of you remember Patrick from the first and second building? You've heard him speak. Laura Underhill, Sean, okay, Sherry, Blanca? Yeah, okay. So just a handful of us. And I've said this, any other guest ministers watching, I'm sorry, but he's my all-time favorite guest minister. And he is just a great teacher of the word. He's been a friend for 30-ish years, and he's just a huge, huge blessing. And are you going to talk about the chairs? Okay. He bought the first chair at the first building in 1985. He bought the first chair in our second building, the purple ones. And then he bought the first chair in this building, the tan ones. So whenever we're going to do something, I call, Patrick, we're buying chairs. You're going to buy a chair. So he's just been a huge blessing to us in so many different ways. So let's give a great Abiding Word Church welcome to Reverend Patrick Norris. Right here, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow. Quite an introduction. I would have written more if I had known he was going to say all that. Wow, what an honor it is to be here with you all. This is my first time to be in this building, and this is amazing. I mean, this is beautiful. This is like over the top. It's like inspirational. It's awesome. And I just applaud all of you all for being a part of the dream that would make this happen. I think back in the first time that I came through and ministered at the church in 85. Can you believe that? 1985. That's a long time ago. And I remember ministering in that first little white old church building. And then the years that I met Pastor Scott and Terry and the friendship that we've developed. These are two of our favorite people. We love them with a deep love. You guys are amazingly privileged to have the quality of pastors that you have. I was telling Pastor Scott and Terry back in the office before we came out, I was telling them how much I admire the giftings that are in them. and how much this social power that Pastor Scott goes into the community with and integrates with every group of people, and he is in every club and in every... If there's anybody in town that should be known, he knows who they are, and he has had coffee, lunch, or at least posted something about them on social media. Absolutely amazing. And as a pastor, I admire that in your pastors and the love that they have for all of you, the persistence, the faithfulness. I'm telling you, if I'm ever in a battle, I want them in the foxhole with me. Because I have watched over these years, whenever the bullets are flying, they ain't doing anything but standing tall, standing on the word, and refusing to compromise. I want people like that in my life. I want friends like that. And I feel so honored and privileged that I get to have Pastor Scott and Pastor Terry as my friends. So honored to be here at your great church and in this great building, and I'm excited. We had such an amazing time with the men on Friday night and then this morning. And if you weren't here, if you're a man and you weren't here, I strongly encourage, and I'll talk to you ladies, if you have a man in your life, if you have teenage sons, or you are married, or you have a boyfriend, it ought to be a requirement. I'm not going to eat with you. I'm not drinking coffee with you. It's an ultimatum. I'm going to hold you accountable. You got to watch or listen to Friday night and Saturday. I believe that it's the catalyst that'll change the quality of your relationship. I believe that it will set up language for you to be able to understand why a man does what a man does. We talked on biblical masculinity, and we dealt with areas of life that I think are in incredibly important and are rarely talked about, particularly within Christianity. So that's just a tip, and all you ladies, you're welcome. All you ladies, you're welcome. So blessed that your guys showed up. I mean, it's amazing. We had, I think, 40 guys Friday night, and then we had 30-something this morning. That's amazing. And so I just applaud you as a church and a church family. I wanted to more formally introduce my family. If you could pull that back up, that would be amazing. This is my beautiful wife in the middle. Can you believe I rated her? Can you believe God? We met on a blind date. Remember one of our spiritual mentors, it was Mom Hagen. I introduced her to Mom, and I said, we got introduced on a blind date. And I said, then God healed her after the date, and after I had her heart. And Mom looked at me like, what? And so, anyway, we did meet on a blind date. So, if you're single and you ever went on a blind date, I want you to know I'm proof. It does work sometimes. I didn't want to go, just as backstory. I didn't want to go on a blind date because the pressure's too hot. You know, on a blind date, you either got to marry him or never see him again. Because you both know that this didn't work and so it's like this pressure of that whole deal. Well, thankfully, I ended up getting to marry her. And then these two youngins came along right after that. We have Evan, who's on the right side with the curly hair. He'll be 24 tomorrow. He is a graphic designer and works in youth ministry at a large church in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then Mitchell, the one with the glasses, he's 21, and he is in Sydney, Australia, going to Bible college. He's a preaching machine. They both are. When Evan preaches, it's just pure heart. I mean, he takes you on an emotional journey, and you feel what he feels. And he's so present with what he's talking about. He's articulate. He's tuned in. He understands what's going on below the surface. He's got the language for it. Amazing. Mitchell, he's like a machine gun. He rolls into a place, and when he gets wound up, it's just, I mean, he's driving it, making it happen, and everybody gets inspired. Tina and I are so proud of these guys. I'm so grateful to God for my family. Anyway, I just thought you might want to have a look at what my family looks like, and I know you're like, no, you did a Google search for good-looking families, and you just stole that. There is no way you came up with that. No way you came up with that. I love it. Well, tonight I want to talk to you about your emotions. I want to talk to you about breaking free in your life and digging up some roots. Breaking free and digging up some roots. When we think about emotions, I want you to capture this idea. When we talk about emotions, we're not just talking about a feeling. We're not just talking about a mood. We're actually talking about what ends up being characteristic of how you measure spirituality. Think about this. When you think of somebody who is quote-unquote spiritual, and you think, man, those people are mature Christians, they're mature Christians, you listen to the verbiage that describes who they are, and you will hear a lot about emotional regulation, emotional health. You'll hear about somebody who is always joyful, somebody who's able to enter into a certain stress moments, and they just are peaceful. You sense this kind of stabilization around how they manage relationships, again, on an emotional level. They're not people who are, on the contrast, who are toxic. You never hear anybody being told, man, they are an amazing Christian, and they're toxic, but boy, they're amazing in their Christianity. You never hear that. Isn't it interesting how we listen to our spiritual life and we talk about it in such emotional frameworks, but then we tend in Christianity to avoid anything that has to do with our emotions? So if you're emotionally healthy and strong, it tends towards helping your spirituality. Shouldn't it be within church that we talk about your emotions? Now, we all, it doesn't matter who you are, how long you've been alive, we've all had T-bones where you were just driving through in life and somebody hit you in a side head-on collision, head-on with them hitting you as you were unexpecting it, and it grieved you, it wounded you. It disappointed and disrupted, destroyed some things in you. You've had things where there was a cost that you had a high value of something, and now you've lost it. You've had something where you were betrayed in your life. Maybe it's a verbal abuse. Maybe you experienced a divorce, and it was your divorce, or maybe it was your parents' divorce. Maybe you experienced the death of a loved one, and it was due to another person's negligence. Maybe you've experienced a false witness. Somebody is accusing you of something and they have no background and they've made up a story, but you have become the victim of it. Maybe in the betrayal, this thing cost you the network of your close friendships. And now people are believing things about you, and through the betrayal, not only are you experiencing the breakdown of that relationship, but it's spread like a virus, and others have dealt with it. And so today, maybe you're thinking, I don't know that I can forgive a person like that. I don't know that I can let this thing go. You may be thinking, if she doesn't apologize, I just don't know how in the world I could ever be free from what they did. You may be thinking that what they did has ruined your life. It stole opportunities from you. It kept you from having some of the things that you thought one day you might be able to have. But today you have your legs pulled out from under you because you are aware what they did has impacted my future, my dreams. Think about that. I wonder what it is for you. I wonder what has taken a chunk of your soul. I wonder what has taken a chunk of who you are and demeaned it. And so today, you feel like you're not your whole self. You're not even living in your whole dream. You're not walking out what things used to cause you to be inspired. Maybe it was a mother who criticized your parenting skills. Maybe it's a colleague who sabotaged a project, or a partner who had an affair. Maybe it was a coach who wouldn't give you any team leadership and you felt like you never got the opportunity. Maybe a drunk driver took the life of a child, or your daughter's addiction and your desire to rescue them has cost you enormous amounts of money. Maybe your uncle abused you throughout your life, physically, verbally, or God forbid, sexually. Maybe the popular kids at school made you the object of their humor. They love to mock or make fun of something about you, your dress, your humor, the way you did your hair. Maybe you have a boss or had one that disrespected you in front of all your colleagues, and it stripped all the sense of your dignity away from you. Now, see, when we talk about this stuff, I'm sure that just giving you headlines, just giving you examples, there are things that are surfacing in your mind that have happened in your life, wounds that have taken place, roots of bitterness that have begun to grow in you, sadness, sorrow. I think if you begin thinking about all of those things and then you think of this word forgiveness, what it means to forgive, you realize rationally, right? You realize intellectually, you realize logically that to forgive sets you up for a healthier life. And if it sets you up for a healthier life, that means you're going to have emotional strength, emotional stability, emotional hope. And in that, you also know that your spiritual life will thrive. And in your spiritual life, you move from faith to faith and glory to glory, and you experience more of God than what otherwise you would. And so you realize, if I forgive, I'm a healthier me. And it causes you to have a better psychological being. It helps you have less anxiety, less stress, less hostility. And then physically, you know, it lowers your blood pressure. We know that there's an association of heart problems and actually your increased risk of cancer. And there's so many illnesses that are associated with these wounds and how we manage the emotional side of these wounds. And so what ends up taking place is that when somebody does us wrong, we drink the poison hoping it'll kill them. And it never kills them. It just hurts you and all your other relationships, your marriage, your kids, your friends, your colleagues at work. We know that when we hold on to these wounds, that our self-esteem is inflamed negatively, that we have narratives that continually thrive at a very deep emotional level, and it impacts the length of our days. And so if we're unforgiving, we realize that it's going to undermine, it's like an undertow in the ocean, it's going to pull us out into places of life we don't want to go. When I think of all this, and then I think, so what do we do? What do we do? How do we walk in emotional health, or something deeper than that? How do we live in spiritual health? Now, let me just say this. I've been telling the men, Friday night and Saturday morning, this morning, I've been telling them that the opposite of sin is health. That God is not OCD about sin, even though modern-day fundamental evangelicalism has caused behaviorism for us to be obsessed about the behaviors and the choices and the actions or activities of people. Did they do? Did they say? Are they involved in? And God's like, I don't care about all that. What God cares about is what is the system that is driving those choices. He cares about what's happening in your underworld that has brought you to the place that you're at. And God loves you so much that anything that threatens your health, He hates. And the reason He hates sin is because sin will destroy you. So God's not focused on the act, He's focused on you. You are the apple of His eye. You are the focus of His love. You are the one that He's in a good mood to. You're the one that He draws close to Him. I said this last night, but if you consider all of your life and all the choices and all the negative things you've done, all the sins that have piled up, let's just call it a big old pile of manure, right? You've got a big pile of manure. And in this big pile of manure, you see yourself on one side of the pile, and you see Jesus on the other side of the pile. And when you see and you look at all of the smell and the different things you did in different seasons of your life, but it's just a big pile of manure. And here you are looking at it, and you're on one side looking to Jesus on the other, and you envision that Jesus is kind of looking around the pile, and as he's trying to see what's going on with you, he's like, hey man, I love you, but you got a big pile of manure between us. I love you, but we got to get this pile of manure figured out so that I can get close to you. That's how most Christians think. But this is what's biblical. Jesus isn't on this side of your manure pile. Jesus has, through the cross in redemption, walked over on your side of the manure pile. He throws his arm around you and he says, boy, that is a big pile of manure right there you got. And he says, we're going to spend the rest of our lives together working on that pile of manure, and I'm so excited to do it with you. God hates sin because of what sin does to destroy you. The opposite of sin is health. God wants you to be healthy. He wants you to be healthy in your emotions. He wants you to be healthy in your spirit, in the way that you live out of your heart. And if you're healthy in those areas, you will be healthy in everything that you endeavor to do. And this is very big to God. So if you ask me, what does it mean to forgive? I probably could have come up with some definitions a few years ago. I probably could have given you the street quotes. I could have gone on social media and extracted everything every preacher ever says. But if I'm transparent, and I am transparent, if I'm transparent, I would be honest with you to say that it didn't satisfy me. So much about forgiving seemed to be a bit shallow. I didn't even understand what it was. It's like, this seems so light. It seems so diluted, and I don't understand it. I remember going on a week-long retreat as I'm working through wounds. This is some years back, many years back, and I'm on this retreat at a pastor's kind of retreat facility. I have my own home. Nobody's bugging me, and I'm praying for a week. I'm just spending time with God, and I'm being dealt with by the Lord to deal with some of my T-bones, some of my wounds, some of the roots of bitterness that have happened over my lifetime. And I'm crying some, and I'm singing some, and I'm mad some, and it's just all these emotions. And I have a book with me, and it tells me that the word forgive in the original language, the word forgive has to do with turning from a thing. The word forgive has to do with releasing a debt. And I'm sitting there thinking, and I'm sarcastic. I'm like, God, what debt am I letting go of? What's the debt? What is it that they owe me that I'm letting go of? So if I'm forgiving them, I'm saying, you owe me nothing. It's like, I don't get it. And I was frustrated. And I didn't get any clarity that week on it. And I just did the best I could. And I said, Lord, I forgive them. I don't know what else to do about it. I forgive them. I release the debt. Woohoo! There it is. Didn't sense any big difference inside of me. It was about 2 years ago or less that I was preparing a series, and God revealed to me this, what ends up for me being more of a silver bullet. It's this beautiful and powerful concept of forgiveness and what it means to release a debt. And if I could walk you through it, because I know that you have had something happen in your life that has marked you, that has inked you, that has caused you to have these power energy reactions that you're like, that doesn't even make logical sense that I act crazy. You got a little cray-cray in you. In fact, look at your neighbor and say, I know you got some cray-cray in you. Just do it. Just do it. Tell them, I know you got some cray-cray in you. You do. So I want to walk you through some things Jesus taught us about forgiveness, and I believe by the end of tonight, your life is going to be different than when you walked in. I believe that it's a game-changing night. I believe that there's going to be some healing for you. I believe that you're going to have a release from some of the things that you just couldn't seem to move forward on. So let's begin in Luke chapter 17. Luke chapter 17, all the scriptures are going to be on the screen. Luke 17 and in verse 4. Jesus starts out by saying, if he, a brother, trespass against you seven times in a day, and seven times in a day turn again to you saying, I repent, you must forgive him. Now again, I want you to consider, Jesus is talking about forgiveness. Forgiveness. Releasing a debt. And he says that the person who trespasses against you does it seven times in a day. How many of you think maybe this person's a bit toxic? Seven times in a day. Now, I will say this. If I were counseling you and you had somebody seven times in a day this just running ripshod over you, I'm going to encourage you to build your understanding of boundaries up. Because there's boundary failure somewhere in your life. If you're around a toxic person and they're doing it seven times, there ought to be a new way that you interact with them where you're able to stay emotionally safe, and in your safety, you're able to be generous with them. The goal of our Christian walk is not that we let anybody do whatever they want to us. It's that we understand how to live in boundaries. We know what we want. We know what we don't want. We know how to live, and we know what the way we're not going to live. And we live in the integrity of that. We're aligned from our inside to our behaviors, and we live that out. And as we're living that out, if people violate those boundaries, then we have consequences that are not retribution. We're not now then giving them some kind of payback. We're just simply saying, no, I'm pulling back. If you're going to do that, then this is how I'm going to choose to live my life. I will live this way so that I can be emotionally safe in the relationship. And if I'm emotionally safe in the relationship, that may mean that I'm not going to hang out with you anymore. Because I find, and this is amazing, and this is the heart of it, I find that I can be more generous with some people in my heart. I can think positive thoughts. I can give myself to them. I can pray for them with compassion if I don't have to be around them all the time. And ultimately, you need to guard your heart where your compassion is concerned. He says that this person does it seven times in a day, but here's where it gets even a little messier. It's a brother. It's somebody you're close to. I mean, there's some people in your life, like the person who works at the Casey's convenience store, that somehow bugs you. And they say something that pushes your buttons. Well, just don't go to Casey's. That's easy. But when it's a brother, it's like the confusion of where do I begin and where do I end? And where do they begin and where do they end? And you know what they bring into my life? Am I not just subjected to that simply because I'm a brother? And then in Christianity, tell me this doesn't get confusing, because in Christianity, we're so bent on, oh, I just need to love everybody. I just need to love everybody. And what we think that means is I let anybody treat me any way they want, and then I say, I'm just going to walk in love. And what that is on a mental health level is that is suppression or repression. What you're doing is you're pushing down real emotions, and you're doing it in the name of God, and God would say to you, stop it, don't do that. Lean into the emotions, find out what they're saying, and become healthy. Now, tomorrow morning, my intent is, and I reserve the right to change my mind. I'll call an audible perhaps in the morning. But as of right now, I'm going to talk to you some about how to deal with toxic people and how to restore yourself by virtue of how you live in boundaries. It's going to be amazing. I believe it could. In our church at Kansas City, there are people that tell me that when they heard what boundaries were really like, and what would happen if you don't live in boundaries, and then how to construct them, they said that it changed everything in their life. Everything. It's the way you live in health. And it's based in free moral agency, that God gave you the power to choose. So here when we talk about somebody doing you wrong, he's emphasizing the most extreme. If you have a brother who does this seven times in a day, turns to you and says, I repent, I give you my allegiance again, you got to forgive him. Now I do want to say this in case anybody's confused. Forgiveness is not the same as trust. So if somebody is abusing you, somebody is toxic and they're hurting you, that does not equate with that if you forgive them, if you release the debt, now then you go back to ground zero, you hit reset, and you start the game over. No. You took a chunk of my soul, you took a chunk of my trust, and now then you're going to have to rebuild that trust. Now I can tell you, for most anything that happens, you can restore. As Pastor said in my bio, I am a certified sexual addiction professional. I don't have clients. I don't work with couples one-on-one, but I have had the training in that regard. Could meet with couples as people who are coming out of massive addictive behaviors. Well, you understand in a husband and wife marriage, particularly when the wife finds out that the husband has been just inordinately and excessively acting outside the marriage and breaking down trust, it looks impossible for there to ever be trust to be restored. But I can tell you that we have examples, hundreds and even thousands of examples, of the worst and most gross violations of trust. But if they go through a healthy process, and Jesus would talk about these kinds of principles, if they go through a healthy process, they can actually, and we have literally thousands of case studies that I could pull up, thousands of them, where the marriage is actually better. The marriage was chaotic because while the acting out was taking place, there was gaslighting going on, and the woman was thinking, I'm crazy. I can't predict. I don't understand. I can't interpret him. He's nuts. And making me feel like I'm nuts. And there's no intimacy in the relationship. After the acting out happens, finally, there is a rebuilding of trust. It's methodic. It's principled. And from that, the marriage is better than it's ever been, and really better than anything that they knew they could have. I want you to know that forgiveness is something you do for you. Forgiveness is something you do to gift yourself. Trust is something that has to be done in mutual, and the mutual interaction, and the other person has to rebuild the trust once it's broken. So I'm not at all saying that if you have been physically abused, verbally abused, in the name of God, you forgive them, meaning to you that you trust them immediately. No, you can forgive them for you and what God does in you, and then say, there's a boundary, and now then these are the things that you're going to have to do to rebuild the trust. And it's not retribution, and it's not trying to get payment from them. It's just simply saying that for me to trust you, you wounded me in my limbic brain, you wounded me in my emotional brain, and now for that to get restored and reprocessed, I've got to have examples. I've got to rebuild instincts in me that if there's a shadow of doubt, I don't default to, you betrayed me again. I have to rebuild that. So that Jesus says that it's important for you that you forgive. And in verse 5, the apostles said unto the Lord, increase our faith. Don't you think that's funny? This person's violated me seven times in a day. It's a brother. And so the disciples, they're just shaking their head, and they're like, Jesus, you better give me some more faith, because I don't know how any human being is going to do that. Increase our faith. And the Lord said, if you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you might say unto the sycamine tree, be thou plucked up by the root, and be thou planted in the sea, and it would obey you. So he says again, the sycamine tree needs to be plucked up by the root. Now, it seems as though we read texts like this and we pick pieces of it and almost feel like Jesus has ADD. Thank you. Where he will talk about something and then he talks about what appears to be completely different than that, and it's almost like he's talking along in squirrel. Talks along squirrel. And it seems as though that's what he's doing. He's talking about forgiveness. Squirrel, I'm going to talk about faith a little bit. I think it's also interesting that the disciples innately believe that to forgive somebody required faith. And they said, you're going to have to increase our faith. And Jesus said, all you need is faith is a grain of mustard seed. That's it. And then he talks about a sycamore tree. I think that's fascinating. He's still talking about forgiving the brother who has violated you seven times in a day. And he says, because of what your brother did seven times in a day, that doesn't mean that you don't have residue of wounding and pain from what they did. Just because you are forgiving them doesn't mean that now you don't have residue from it. And what he's saying is that the seven violations in a day began to plant what's called a sycamine tree. And this sycamine tree is growing up inside of you and causing you to live in a way that you don't even know why you're living the way you're living. You don't even know why you're acting the way you're acting. And he says, to deal with this violation, betrayal, wounding, you're going to have to take the sycamine tree and you're going to have to do more than just deal with surface issues. You're going to have to get down into the root system of it and you're going to have to pluck that thing up. And when you do, you're going to live a completely different quality of life. So when he talks about a sycamine tree, this sycamine tree is an interesting tree. There's four different things that Jesus is meaning when he talks about the sycamine tree. And these are the secrets of the sycamine tree. Now, the sycamine tree is similar to the mulberry tree in that it looked very similar. The thing about a mulberry tree is it had a sweet fruit. But the sycamine tree, on the other hand, it did not. In fact, we'll start with the first bullet. The sycamine tree had a very large and deep root structure. Because it was very large and the root structure so deep that if there was no water in desert eastern cultures, if there was no water, the sycamine tree could thrive because the root system would be so deep it could grab the water below the surface and still thrive. Sounds very similar to the bitterness you and I experience. When we're wounded, that bitter taste in our heart, our emotions, that feeling of high energy emotion that grieves our hearts, grieves our minds. That has a deep level root system. Isn't it crazy how deep it is that you can be 10 years removed from it? Somebody asks you, what is that person doing? And you then begin together to relive what they did to you, and it is using the water from 10 years ago. And it's sucking that water up, and you're once again re-inflamed with something you thought, I thought I was over that. I thought I had grown beyond that. And now I'm just ticked off at those people again. I'm grieved all over again. I'm angry all over again. Had a very large and deep root structure. It also produced a fig that was very bitter to eat. It looked like the mulberry fig, but this fig was something that was so bitter that when the poor people, it was generally the under-resourced that would eat the sycamine fruit, and because it was so bitter, they would nibble on it. And so it wasn't something you could consume immediately. Sweet things you can eat quickly. Today, after I've been on a keto diet for a while, to get into ketosis, so I hadn't been able to eat a lot of sugar and, you know, carbohydrates. So we go to Arthur's Deli, and they highlighted to me the Eli's Cheesecake from Chicago. I said, yes, Lord, yes, to your will and to your way, yes. And when I ate it, so I was absolutely full after lunch, and I take it home, haven't touched it, take it to the hotel, I put it in the fridge, and I'm sitting there, I'm laying in my bed looking for a football game, and I'm thinking about that cheesecake. I'm sure it's lonely, it's needing some attention. And so I convinced myself, you're so full, you're at the level of sin already, eating too much. And I convinced myself, well, I won't eat the whole thing. I'm just going to get a bite, maybe one cherry, just a little bite. And that first bite was so smooth. I mean, I could just feel myself getting a little woozy, almost drunk, intoxicated. I'm like, oh, my gosh, that's incredible. Before I know it, I ate the whole thing. Every cherry, all the sauce. In fact, I almost put my tongue right down in the grooves of the container and just licked it all up, man. And it's interesting when you eat something sweet how fast it goes. But when it's something that's bitter, you don't eat it fast. You nibble it. And when somebody's done something to you that is wounding you, we have a tendency to just nibble on it. A little bit here, a little bit there. You're driving down the road. In the tree, you're driving down the road. You ain't thinking about that person. You're not thinking about what they did. And all of a sudden, you're thinking about that person. You think about what they did. And it's not really just about them. It generally starts with the repercussions of what they did. And you associate this network of failure in your life, this network of lost opportunities and the esteem, how you view yourself, and you start feeling all of this less than, not being enough. You just, again, you feel like you're just jacked up, and then you're like, oh, yeah, and they are the ones who did it. And you relive it, and you're nibbling here, little nibble, nibble, nibble. It's like a mind tree. It's interesting because it was pollinated by wasps. Isn't that kind of like the way that you deal with bitterness in your life? It's pollinated by the devil. He loves to make things happen in your life that you can't seem to turn away from, that you're emotionally so attached to it you can't move on. And then the last part is it grew quickly in nearly any environment. That's just like bitterness. Somebody does you wrong. It's not like it's like, okay, I'm going to get out a bunch of resources, I'm going to develop this bitterness, I'm going to develop this unforgiveness, I'm really going to get this thing really big in me. You don't have to do that. I mean, when we live by faith, I mean, if you've ever been a person that found that faith cometh by hearing and hearing by the word, you become diligent to grow in faith. You're going to exercise and get yourself built up, and you're going to have the word in you. Bitterness is something that you don't have to do that with. It's something that, I mean, can be all-consuming to you just in a moment. Just in a moment. I find it interesting that Jesus uses the sycamine tree as the metaphor for somebody who's violated you 7 times in a day. A brother. He looks at this and he is trying to get us to understand what has happened in us. What has happened in us. So let me just switch gears just for a minute. And let's talk about how the enemy pollinates, how the enemy is going to endeavor to take advantage of you and exasperate the wounds that you have sustained. And again, the wounds often are so grievous, it's hard to even state what happened. I mean, some of you in here, you really would fit into, you know, the Me Too movement. You have been violated. Some of you in here have been, as a child, abused. And it has marked you. There are things that has happened throughout your life. You don't understand how it could possibly have happened to you. And for you, it's even created struggles as you want to get close to God, because you're like, God, where were you when I was a kid and I got betrayed, I was violated? Those things are huge. So let's talk just for a minute what the devil does with this bitterness and unforgiveness. If we could, let's look at this scripture in Ephesians chapter 6. It's about the whole armor of God. It's familiar, but I want to highlight something. This is how Paul talks about, as a Christian, that we live in our spiritual strength and wholeness. He says, put on the whole armor of God. As parallel to a Roman soldier, he says that you could stand against the wiles, the deceptions, the strategies of the devil. So the devil has a strategy. You understand that he's got a plan, and he's working a plan on you. Not just the church at large, but you. He knows your name, he knows your address. And verse 14 says, stand, therefore, having girded your waist with truth. You know why truth is so important? is because truth is what confronts lies. If you know the truth makes you free. It's the truth you believe that sets you free. The emotional belief of truth will cause you to live in freedom. The opposite is true. It is the lies you believe that keep you in bondage. The lies you believe about you keep you in bondage. So when we talk about forgiveness and this wounding that happened to you, for you to forgive them is the gift you give yourself, because in forgiving them, you're able now to restore. You're able now to come back to a whole self. I'll walk you through it. He says that truth, you gird yourself truth, put on the breastplate of righteousness, and then he continues, above all, taking the shield of faith, which you will be able to quench all the fiery darts of the wicked one. I think it's interesting that the enemy's strategy for you is to use an arsenal of fiery darts. You see, this dart or arrow wasn't just like when you watch Western movies, cowboys and Indians, and there is a rock chiseled down, sharp-edged arrow. This fiery dart is an arrow that has a combustible tip. It's a specific dart that is in the Roman arsenal. And when it is shot at the point of impact, it explodes with fire. Let's talk about fire for a minute in the Bible. Do you ever notice the Bible says that a man shouldn't touch a woman? 1 Corinthians 7, shouldn't touch a woman, whereas to cause her to burn. The idea of fire. John the Baptist would say that the one who's coming after me will baptize you with the Holy Spirit and fire. Fire. What is fire? Fire is an intense desire, both in the way a man would touch a woman and how the Holy Spirit, when you're baptized with the Holy Spirit, you become consumed with the desires of God that now then overcome and quench the desires of the world. It burns up the chaff, the lesser important things in your life. So fire is about this energy of desire, this emotional pocket of energy. Now watch this. He says that the enemy shoots you a fiery dart. What is it? It's to explode your emotions. It's to give you a hyper reaction to whatever circumstances are. This is the plan of the enemy to destroy you. And what we do is with the shield of faith, we quench the fiery darts of the wicked one. Isn't that interesting? Now, when you think of this energy, you think of this intense desire, this reactive power that is on the inside of you, and it's not rational. It doesn't make sense to you, and in fact, you know what it's like to have this firestorm of chemicals washing over your brain, and in the moment, everything just makes so much sense. This is just wrong, and you start saying things that hurt everybody. I mean, you're shooting bullets every which direction. You're just in the moment. It all makes sense. You want to argue. You want to fight, and then when the chemicals, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours later, start leaving your brain, you sit there and you're like, why did it make so much sense for me to be a jerk 2 hours ago? But right now, I realize none of that was justifiable. The limbic system of your brain got triggered and you fired it up. And in firing it up, you were living in an emotional moment that was so captivating. It enslaved you. It just enslaved you. And you, when the chemicals start leaving your limbic brain, all of a sudden you're in your prefrontal cortex, the part of your logical brain, your rational brain, and now then you're back to, oh wow, this is different now than what I thought it was a minute ago. What the enemy's doing is he's trying to fire up your emotions. When it comes to compulsive behavior and addictive behavior, you know, when the thing that you wish you didn't do, so every one of you in here, you have your kryptonite. Every one of you in here have something that you feel condemned about because you can't seem to stop doing it. For some of you, it could be gossip. You're like, I got to stop that. This is hurting my relationships. I got to stop it. For some of you, it's an outrageous rage. You're just raging. And you least expect it. You walk in the house and you don't even know why, but you hit from 0 to 10 in a second. And you are hotter than fire. And it breaks things down in your life. Others of you, it's spending money. You're just emotionally dysregulated. You want to medicate, and so you go buy stuff. You love to go to budgeting classes and courses, which I would encourage everybody to do. But what happens is, in a moment, you're like, I don't care what's on that budget. I won't buy some. And sometimes you buy houses or cars, things that now you've committed your life to for 20 years, 30 years, and you're upside down. You have no margin, and you're medicating. All this is about the fiery darts that has caused you now to live intoxicated. You're drunk in life. You can't see right. You can't think right. That's the fiery darts. I want you to see this text in Hebrews. The Apostle Paul gives us this. He says, pursue peace. Peace is the Greek word eirene. In the Hebrew, it's from the word shalom. Pursue wholeness, nothing broken, nothing missing, to be at one again, to be at peace with all people, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God. Now watch this. Lest any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble, and by this many become defiled. Now let's break it down. He calls it a root of bitterness. Isn't it interesting that he says this isn't just bitter, it's you got roots, baby. You got roots. You know, the next time your partner goes off and is doing something that's just beyond, just say, you know, you got roots. You probably shouldn't do that. It might create bigger problems, but it'd be funny if you did. You know, I think that's your roots. Just tell them that. I told the guys about a time that we were driving back from vacation. My kids were elementary age. And as we're driving back from vacation, we're about an hour outside of Kansas City, been at the beach, I'm relaxed, everything's great, but they start picking on each other. They just, you know, they've been in the car for 18 hours, and it's a Toyota Camry, back seat, not very big, and, you know, he touched me, and then it's not just he touched me, it's his coat touched, well, it wouldn't be a coat in the summer, his blanket touched me, it's something, his iPad or whatever he had at the time, something touched me, and it's just back and forth, and it's just bickering. And my personality is one where I'm pretty chill. I have a good time. We laugh and just have a great time until there's stress. Once stress enters in, then I move towards rules because rules psychologically make me feel the predictability of safety. It makes me feel like I'm going to be okay. And so I say, hey, guys. I turn around. I'm driving. I turn around and say, hey, guys, I want you to stop, and here's what I'm telling you. There is a line right here between the seats. Do you understand that? I don't want you to talk to each other for the next hour until we get home. And if you have something you want to say to the other one, talk to me first. I did say that. And then I said, I don't want you touching each other. I don't want your hair touching each other. I don't even want your shadow to get on the other side. And I said, I want this to stop. I want it to stop right now. Do both of you understand me? And they'd grown up earlier in their life in the South, and so, yes, sir. It was a yes, sir. And I said, do you understand? And I reiterated to make sure they understand. Is there anything that I've said right now that you don't understand? No, sir, I understand. Great. Well, you know, in my mind, that should last for at least a half hour. We're only an hour from home. You know, you're banking on we could get home. I'm talking within 3 minutes, it all fires back up again. When it did, I exploded. It's one of those things you're not proud of. I exploded. And fire in my eyes. The judgment of God was coming to bear. And they were before the judgment seat of Christ or the white throne judgment, one of the two. They were there. And I mean, and my anger is damaging them, which I had to repair when I got home. Damaged them. So what was going on in me? See, I wasn't mad because they were violating each other. They were being kids. That doesn't mean that they shouldn't be held accountable. Doesn't mean that they should be disciplined about it. What it does mean is that what my anger was doing is there is a root system that was over a lifetime of feeling unseen, unheard, disrespected. And as a pastor, I had come through a season where my senior staff were all disrespecting me. They were all doing things as though I didn't have a say. They were all, and they had power because there was a group of them that could leave our church and ended up leaving. They were all family and they could leave. And so the thought inside of me is, I'm just being transparent. By God, I may not have power over anybody else, but I do have power over you two boys. I will be heard. Now, I want you to notice, it was the roots that I was talking to them from. You know, when you're crazy, it's not what just happened in front of you that you're crazy by. You're crazy because, well, you got roots. Next time you're interacting, just stop and say, whoa, I'm being crazy right here. There's a lot of energy I'm coming at you with. I'm calling myself out. Just roots. Just learn to say, those are roots right there. That's just roots. I'm coming at you with the bondage and the wounds of a lifetime. Things that my dad did, things that my mom did, things that my siblings did, things that a coach did, those things have created an emotional identity for me, and that's what I'm firing off at you with in this moment. When he says here that it's a root of bitterness, it is bitter that is deep within your soul and it springs up. I think the interesting phrase of springing up means that this is taking you by surprise. It was not predictable. It went from 0 to 100 in a second and you, it just, bam, it's there. Have y'all ever had that happen? I'm glad that there's a few of you that tell the truth. If you're human, that's happened to you. It springs up. And as Christians, don't we do this? Don't we be like, man, it's been like a month since I've done anything crazy. I haven't jolted. I haven't fired off. I haven't done. Man, I'm really doing good. And you think I've regulated everything. And when you least expect it, out of nowhere, this thing fires up again. And you're like, I thought I'd moved forward. No, watch this. He says that the root of bitterness will spring up and it'll trouble you. And the word trouble in the Greek means to excite or to annoy or to disturb you. Isn't that what happens to you when you go crazy? Something's just annoyed you. And in the moment, you don't even know what's annoying you. Because it's not the thing in front of you. It's not the event you just experienced. It's something that is much bigger. It's the roots that are down below it. They excite you, annoy you, and disturb you. And by this, many become defiled. The word defiled means to die, to stain, or contaminate. It's what you and I would understand to have a tattoo. But this tattoo is in your soul. This tattoo is deep within your emotion. And neurobiologically, it's in your brain. Neurobiologically, it's in the limbic system of your brain. And it's in files in a place called the hippocampus. And no, that's not an African animal. It's where all of your emotional wounded memories reside. Now I want you to notice that the enemy is trying to exasperate this right here. This is what the enemy is trying to do to you, to destroy you. So if we can hit back to the Luke chapter 17, to what Jesus is saying about forgiving, he says, the disciples say, increase our faith. And if you had faith as a grain of mustard seed, you'd say to the sycamine tree, be plucked up by the root and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. I'm going to close this up. Now, I've asked you to forgive me. Did we say 720? Yeah, that's what I thought we said. I'm going to close this up. Now, listen. When the word forgive means to release a debt, here's what it means, and you gotta listen fast. I'll pick up with it in the morning. But what it means to release a debt, the debt is because you wounded me, I'm now living in self-doubt. I have energy in myself that questions the stability of my future. I question my hopes and dreams. I question my own safety. Because you've done to me what you've done, I am questioning who I am and what I believe about myself. And because of what you've done, what I feel subconsciously that you owe me is I feel that you owe me to restore me back to where I was before you wounded me. So the debt you release is this. You say, okay, because of what, this is what you do internally, because of what you think this, because of what you did to me, I'm now then differentiating. That's a big word. I'm differentiating. You're not me, and I'm not you. Because you're not me, and I'm not you, I'm first going to identify I am not enmeshed with you. I know who I am, and I know who I'm not. I know who you are, and I know who you're not. You're not me. And so the first piece of forgiveness is I differentiate. I'm going to separate myself. I'm going to differentiate myself emotionally and in ideas of boundaries that I'm not you, you're not me. And I now, this is what forgiveness does. Forgiveness says, you're here, I'm here, and I'm releasing the debt. You don't owe me anything for me to restore. You don't have to apologize to us. And you guys know what it's like for somebody to apologize to you. And after, I mean, if you have the privilege of getting an apology, which often you don't. But if you, because this is what we think. If you just apologize to me, it would reset me. It'd let me know that you were wrong. And because you were wrong, now I can feel better about myself. That energy I developed because of what you did. Now then, if you apologize, I'm going to go back to a reset. I'm going to start a new game in my life. And I'm going to be brand new again like I was before. So what forgiveness says is, no, I differentiate from you. I don't need you for me to restore to who God designed me to be. So because I don't need you, that doesn't mean that if you do apologize and you do rebuild trust, that God can't use that. I'm just saying I'm not going to depend on you to decide who I am and what I emotionally feel about my own identity. I'm releasing you from the debt of owing me my recovery. So what I do, and look at the screen, I differentiate myself and release them. I clarify my boundaries. And then from that, I begin to work on my own recovery. I begin to work on who I am. And when I work, what do? One of the best ways is I lean into a community of intimate friends who can speak encouragement into my life. Because just like you're wounded in relationships, you're healed in relationships. And so you move away from the relationship that has wounded you, and then you trust and you become vulnerable to a group of people who see you, who know you, who get you, and you allow them to speak into your life to help you restore. And what you do then, biblically, and this is what Jesus would say, is you speak to the bitter pain. Now, when you're in the emotional experience of the wound, your limbic brain, when you're in the emotional moment, if the limbic brain opens up, and you can begin in that emotional moment, speak to the pain. You can speak to it. You can speak to the wound. You can speak to the fiery darts. And there is something that happens in your speaking that reprocesses the limbic brain and causes that limbic brain to diffuse the energy pocket and to pull the roots up from the very, very bottom that's getting all of its resourcing. And then it, from there, it casts that thing into the sea. Jesus is simply teaching us what we understand in brain scan technology today. He's teaching us how to restore our souls. He's teaching us how to live in the health of our identity emotionally, even when somebody has wounded us. And then we let faith rise that God is the source of our dreams. He's the source of our identity. No other person is. Let's pray. Dear God, I...